KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. My guest, Bobcat Goldthwait, as a comic, has made awkwardness into a kind of an art form. And as a writer-director, he's made awkwardness a much more intimate and personal thing, as you would know from his movies such as, well, its original title was Stay, which I liked a lot better than Sleeping Dogs Lie.
Yeah, me too, but there was another Stay at the time.
There's the one with Ewan McGregor, right?
Yeah, Naomi Watts, a Mark Forster movie. And yeah, I always hope that someone accidentally rents that thinking there's some bestiality in it. Like, hey, that's my goal. You know? Naomi Watts better get busy with this dog because this is not the movie I heard about.
Well, before we get into talking about your new film as a writer-director, World's Greatest Dad, we should talk a little about Sleeping Dogs Lie, which I saw at Sundance. And I told you there how much I liked the film. And tell audiences what the film is about, because all the descriptions kind of dance around.
Yeah, it is a romantic comedy with a tasteful amount of bestiality. It isn't what drives the movie. I mean, I just needed something that people couldn't get past, and I was trying to explore the fact that, you know, it's the lies that we tell about ourselves. This is what makes us better people.
Would you say it's about that incident and then this woman trying to deal with her life afterwards?
Yeah, but it's not about, like, her getting past, like, what would lead up to that. It was something she immediately regretted, and it's not a movie about bestiality.
No, that's
the point I was trying to make.
That's what I was saying, too. It's about the repercussions of the decision.
Yeah, and everybody – I think a lot of people hurt a lot of people under the guise of being honest. Hey, man, I was just being honest. And I really don't like that. It's a form of cruelty. And so that movie was about unconditional love. And I say these kind of things, and I think you got to understand, like, if I heard me talking, you know, about film and unconditional love, and this is Bobcat Goldthwait, you know, I would have to punch myself in the throat. I would really be turned off because as I direct more, it gives me permission to be a blowhard.
That's fascinating to me because I always thought your stage act was about dealing with that kind of that awkwardness about dishonesty. And the movies really kind of take that and make it very kind of intimate, and the way people deceive themselves about how if they kind of keep this thing hidden, it's not going to affect their lives at all.
Well, thanks. You know, it's weird that I had this persona, and I still, by the way, drag it out when I need to make money. You know?
So you're still doing stand-up?
Oh, yeah. I do stand-up. It's funny. I do stand-up so I can afford to keep making these small movies. You know, that's what I do. It keeps me off of reality shows. I wish I was kidding about any of this. But
you said to me at Sundance when I said something, you said, well, yeah, these people who talked me up about these movies I was in that I wouldn't even go see if I wasn't in them.
Yeah. And that's sad, but that's the reality. I mean, I took the job, so I can't belittle these things. But these are the decisions I made as a 20-some-year-old man, you know, in my early 20s, you know. So I want to make a short movie where the 47-year-old Bob Cat goes back and I talk myself out of being in Police Academy, a time traveling movie. But you know, I would just tell myself to go, you know, F off, you know. So right now I'm at this point where I hope I can keep making these movies and I really do look at it like I kind of already sold out in a big way, you know, mostly. And now I kind of quit like about 6 years ago and said I'm only going to do things that I enjoy doing and work with people I want, and I don't want to be in things that I would be not proud of.
But I really do think the movies are about certainly the difference between truth and self-delusion, but also just about awkwardness. I mean, because there's awkwardness, a lot of it in World's Greatest Dad before the incident takes place.
Right.
As a stand-up, I just wonder if you just sort of saw when you were starting your act that people are often so awkward anyway, why not just make that a comic persona for yourself? Because usually comics would talk about it, and you enacted it.
Right. Well, my early stand-up, you know, I didn't even have material. It was just this guy who was on stage, and people weren't sure if I had come off the street or not. And I truly was trying to parody stand-up. I was a big fan of, like, Kaufman and Andy Kaufman. And then I got on Letterman when I was 20, and so suddenly I got booked as a headliner, and I had to scramble and write an act. And I really eventually became the very thing I was trying to make fun of.
Because you had to keep feeding the act to keep going on
stage.
I had
to become a comedian. Now people were coming out to see me. You know, before I could do these 20-minute things where I'd go on stage and read a Dear John letter and cry, you know, and that would be my act, you know.
My guest is Bobcat Goldthwait. His new film as writer-director is World's Greatest Dad. But it was also that thing of what you do on stage was Andy Kaufman, which he also – the act was about awkwardness too. And you didn't know if he was going to be funny or not.
Right.
And when he wasn't funny, he liked the kind of reaction that he got out of people. And before you developed an act, was that part of the motivation for you too? You kind of liked the way people were reacting to your parodying what was supposed to happen on stage?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Robin refers to what I do is the comedy of the awkward.
Well, you're talking about Robin Williams, who stars in the movie with Daryl Sabara, who people know from the Spy Kids films.
Yeah, but I didn't know him from the Spy Kids because I hadn't seen those movies. There's two boys. Daryl plays this horrible kid. I love his performance. I think he's really awesome in the movie. And then there's another kid that's his friend who's a sweet kid, and he was sent in to audition for that role. And Daryl just lied to me. I go, "Oh, are you here for Kyle or Andrew?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm here for Kyle." I go, "Oh, okay." You know, I don't, you know, I was like, "Okay." And he read and he just stayed in character. He was this rotten kid, you know, and I loved him that he was so good. But I played back his tape over and over like the Zapruder film, trying to study the moments where he came out of character. And I called everyone. I go, "What is this kid like?" They go, "Daryl, he's an awesome kid."
In the writing of this, I wonder what you – in these situations, because there is that incident that's a part of these films, and we haven't even gotten to Windy City Heat yet. speaking of awkwardness, but there's that moment. I just wonder, as you're writing the films, is the moment that comes first and you figure out how to deal with it, or do you deal in terms of character or what?
Because No, it always comes – it's funny. I remember hearing Albert Brooks talk about that he had come up with the end of Lost in America first. And I thought, well, that's insane, you know. But that's really how I work, you know. It's this idea of without sounding pretentious, the idea of what do I want to say. So the speech that Robin gave at the end of the movie was the first idea, and then I went backwards from there.
We should say the movie's about a guy who's sort of a failed writer and a single dad raising a really rebellious son. And
he's just a horrible kid.
Yeah, and a really awkward teacher who doesn't really know how to come out and be himself. And after his son commits suicide.
Well, it's not suicide.
I'm not trying to give too much away.
Yeah, it's hard to promote the movie because I don't want to give away stuff. But
let's just say after the son dies, he uses this as an occasion to concoct a suicide note and to become the writer he's always wanted to be.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you. I've been doing this for a while.
I got to tell you, I know I sound like I'm such a fan of the show that I always – there's about 90% of the time on your show, the director, you explain to them what their movies are about, and the guy either coughs it up that he didn't realize it, the man or woman coughs it up and goes, oh, yeah, that's what I had in mind. Or they, you know, so that's part of why I'm here. I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing. the theme is nothing is what it seems, and the other theme I think that shows up in these movies that the ones I write that I've made, you know, it's the lies that we tell about ourselves, and it's the lies that we tell ourselves to get through the day is what fascinates me more than anything. It's what I'm thinking about all the time, and it goes from all of the actions that we do, you know, it really does fascinate me.
Well, part of this must be this kind of truth that you came to as you're talking about when you were doing the stand-up and realizing that that wasn't what you wanted to be.
Was
that a part of the way you were leading your life then too? You're sort of concocting these things to keep yourself going on stage?
Yeah, and being around people that go, oh, you would hate it if you weren't performing. It's like, no, man, I would, you know, I would be happy not performing, you know?
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I'm not one of those
guys.
Did
you not get that adrenaline hit on stage?
I get it now when I go out there when I'm doing the alimony tour because I'm up there going, I don't want to not deliver. You know, it's this working class ethic that I grew up with. You know, it's like I got to do a show for the people, sincerely.
Sure.
And then also there's the pressure. You know, you do want to do a good show. But no, I don't enjoy it because it's really being the center of attention, which doesn't interest me too much. And I think that has to do with the healthier I get, the less interest I am.
That's interesting because would you say that when as a person, when you suddenly your act took off and and kind of flew away from you?
Oh,
you
definitely.
Did you then get some thrill out of the idea of writing this wild thing for as long as you could?
No. You know, it really did take off. You know, I would love to teach a course for young people who – do you know what I mean? Like someone who's in the early 20s like myself that exploded, you know, this idea – there are some kids that I've taken aside, kids, but there are some comedians who I've said, hey, look, keep listening to that voice. You know, you are right. You know, like Charlene Yee is one, you know, I've kind of become this crusty old mentor to her where I'm going, you know, you're on the right track. You know, keep listening to this, you know, because don't compromise. Don't sell out. You know, keep pursuing the things that you find funny or that you find interesting, you know, and, you know, because... you know, my life when I'm traveling around doing stand-up is often it's like being in the movie Groundhog's Day, you know, or that sketch, the Chris Farley show, where people are like, remember when you were in that movie with the horse that talked, you know, and I'm like, yeah, that was cool, you know, and you're like, you know, but I also understand that I carry a lot of baggage. You know, so, but you know, it's funny. It doesn't matter who you are. You know, I was listening to Ron Howard on his program. You know, he's still battling with people knowing him from three series that he did. I don't know how many years ago.
40 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's boohoo. You know, my girlfriend would say, "Oh, my diamond shoes are too tight." You know.
By the way, it's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Bobcat Goldthwait. His new film as writer-director is World's Greatest Dad. You come up in that period where you could be a hit doing essentially performance art, because Andy Kaufman was kind of a niche comedian.
Right.
And had he come, and he sort of certainly broke ground because he got started doing that stuff really late 60s, early 70s. And you came basically like 10 years after that when he kind of set a stage for that. And also Letterman was doing that kind of stuff on the show too.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a real place for that.
Yeah, and like
so,
Brother Theodore and folks like that.
Absolutely.
You know, on Letterman, yeah. There are... I think you can address – there's folks now that are reaching out and you know, comedy is becoming very specific. Oh, I'm going to be the redneck comedian. I'm going to be the xenophobic puppet guy. You know, there are – it's really strange, you know, and then you just reach your audience and the rest of the country is not aware of it, you know.
You spend a lot of time in Vegas, so you see examples of that all the time, this kind of specificity where people are doing that one thing and just do it forever.
Yeah, well, more like now because of the YouTubes, you know, that these kids, you know, so I have to post some stand up material because when I go and do stand up, people only know, you know, since I haven't posted any more recent material, people, you know, really think I'm this guy that's going to talk like Grover for 45 minutes. I met Grover, by the way, when I was directing the Kimmel show. And Grover, first of all, Grover's just laying on the floor, and I was like, "Yo, man, that's you know messing me up. You know, can you put the puppet on?" So he puts Grover on, and he goes, "Hi, Bobcat." And two things: I became a kid, and I actually was like, "Hi, Grover." And the other thing was, I was like, "Oh, this is where I got my act." Like I
really?
Yeah, oh, totally. Like I was, I owe the Henson Company a lot of money.
I always wondered that because he always.
Yeah, I was looking at obviously as a kid, I was like, man, I like his chops. That guy's a good actor. He's really solid.
That guy's a good actor.
But you know, when he was laying on the floor, he's like, Grover's legs are all akimbo. You know, he looked like a Ouija photo of
a suicide.
Did
you find yourself doing that thing where? Because it's weird when it happens that when somebody's got a puppet going, you look right at the puppet.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, yeah, and I became a kid. I really did. Like, hi, Grover. So. Remember when you were near and then you were far? Yeah, that was cool.
I don't know what to say, so we should take a break. My guest is writer-director and comic Bobcat Goldthwait. His new film is writer-director, starring Robin Williams, is World's Greatest Dad. I'm a little asphyxiated right now, so we'll take a break. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, the comic writer, director, Bobcat Goldthwait, his new film, Roll Squid Is Dead. I don't know why I'm doing Tom Snyder.
I don't know.
All of a sudden.
But I would like to say I am Bobcat Goldthwait. It's that damn IMDb. They keep calling me Bob Goldthwait. So then when people are being snarky writing about me, I guess he wants to be called Bob Goldthwait now. No, my name is Bobcat. I mean, that's what my friends call me. That's what I've been called since I was 15 or 16. But IMDb, they go, we won't put a nickname on IMDb. And I'm like, well, my real name's Robert. It's like, then you got to change my credits, because then I worked on the James Kimmel show, and then I worked on on the David Chappelle show. They got a beef with Bobcat.
Well, speaking of beefs, though, I meant to ask you this when I saw you in CineVegas a couple of weeks ago. A lot of the reviews, even when they're respectful of you as a filmmaker, they don't seem to know how to treat you. Like they kind of go, well, Bobcat Goldthwait or Bob, that kind of thing.
Right, right. It always starts with this backhanded thing. But that really doesn't bother me at all. Because when they start with that backhanded thing, 9 times out of 10, it goes to this other place. You know, the best reviews for me is, I can't believe I went and saw this movie that Bobcat Goldthwait wrote and I really liked it. That's an awesome review.
But
I understand that. I mean, look, you know, I think Russell Brand's awesome. I think he's really funny. Now, when I talk to my friends from England and I say, oh, I love Russell Brand, they've had a pant load of him already. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not that Russell Brand isn't funny over in the UK. It's just that they saw him in his ups and downs and getting starting and all this stuff. So if you're a journalist writing review, this isn't this undiscovered kid. This is a guy who set The Tonight Show on fire and was on Hollywood Squares. I come with a lot of baggage. You know, it's probably a little bit why I go to Europe with these movies and you know, I'm like Jerry Lewis. No. But the fact that like I don't come with this baggage, so they take the movies serious, you know, and it's really funny. You know, I'm not like saying, oh, I'm a big deal over there, but I've had these experiences where I have like 1,400 people giving the movie a standing O in San Sebastian, you know, and I just started crying, you know.
So that's what I was going to say, because you played Sundance twice now. And, you know, it's not like everybody can get a film to Sundance, because we both know how many films get submitted there.
Yeah, it's so crazy. And I say to people, like, could you imagine you're at Sundance, you know, and you get this DVD and it says written and directed by Bobcat Goldthwait? There's no way they go, oh, this ought to be good. You know what I mean? I guarantee you they go, hey, let's watch this in Screech's movie. I believe it is harder for me that first time to get into Sundance. I know it was, you know, and I don't take it for granted. A lot of people look at Sundance as a stepping stone. I'm going to get a movie in the Sundance, and then I'm going to get discovered. And then I'm going to get a movie in Sundance. To me, Sundance is a destination, because I'm never going to see, even if you have a movie that's a hit and a big deal, you're still not going to see it with people who love movies. You know, packed houses that love movies, you know. I actually felt this last time because of Robin Williams and stuff. I felt that, like, the first screenings were so many people wondering if they're going to buy the movie or not. And people.
Well, that first screening was a really emotional event.
It was really emotional. And I think, like, people were, like, kind of too serious. And then as the movie played through the festival, when I got to Salt Lake City, I was really hoping there'd be like some Mormon families that would, because, you know, when it says, you know, I wanted that to happen, but to go, oh, Robin Williams, I love Flubber, you know, so let's bring the kids, you know, that's what I was hoping for, but that didn't happen. Instead, I got all the, you know, the people who this movie was made for, and that was, you know, they really loved the movie, and that was really cool.
Well, let's talk about that first experience when Stay played.
Stay was a crazy thing. You know, we shot it in 2 weeks.
Really? Wow.
With a crew from Craigslist. You know, so I always like it when people are like, oh, well, you know, the cinematography and the – it's like, look, man, it was like we could either film the whole movie or make, you know, arty shots. And I have a problem with arty. I think, like, when I'm talking to you right now, I'm not slowly moving closer to you. I if it's not a suspense movie and if it's not an action film, or if it doesn't lend itself, I really don't want the camera moving around that much. You know, of course, there's – different places you can put the camera and things that hopefully
change. But this lends to the question, though, or leads to the question, rather. What did you watch? I mean, because as a director, you've got to start at some point just thinking, well, how do I want this to look?
Right.
And when do you know?
I think the movies that always influenced me the most, I always go back to, I think, like the, you know, 80s and 70s Woody Allen movies.
Which are really simple camera setups.
Yeah, and that, like, Crimes and Misdemeanors, actually, that movie is really important to me. And of course, Annie Hall and stuff. And Woody Allen, you know, there's all this awkward stuff going on there that definitely influences me and stuff.
But he was obviously somebody who had to change people's perceptions about him too, because he was a stand-up. Who took film very seriously to the extent that he would really recut the movies. I mean, the movie, then take the money and run stars being one thing. He realized it didn't work and threw stuff out. In some way, that's got to be like a real guiding light for you, the fact that he could like change people's perceptions just by the course of sticking with film over the years.
Yeah, I really don't know about changing people's perspectives because, you know, like it or not, when I'm dead, there's going to be a picture of me in a police uniform, you know. That's the reality. I just want to keep making movies and really – and these small movies. I'm old enough to not ever – and I can promise you now, I will never do a studio picture.
Why would you not do a studio
picture? No notes, man. No notes. I'm getting away with murder. You know, I've made two movies now with no notes. You don't get that, you know. So if I can keep making them small, you know, Ed Wood, you know, that's, you know, Robin calls me Bob Wood, but there's a spirit there, you know. Hey, we can do it, and we don't need money. We don't. We're just gonna do it, you know. And it's very infectious, and I drag my friends along with me, you know. Like a lot of these guys, like Tom Kenny and Robin too, you know. He was in Shakes, and everybody we just keep. You know, I don't know what we're doing. I really think of my approach to making movies as really naive.
By the way, it's The Treatment, I guess, is writer-director Bobcat Goldthwait. His new film as writer-director is World's Greatest Dad. Do you feel like you knew what you're doing more on this one than on the last one? And do you feel more like a director on World's Greatest Dad than
I don't
did?
Feel like a director until you ask me on the show. Serious. And I'm serious. I love directors, so I listen to this show, you know, because you don't get to have a conversation with these guys. You know what I'm saying? I hope I can keep making these movies. I'm not expecting mass appeal ever because...
Well, you know, you said we were talking before. You talked about using music to evoke mood on the set.
Yeah.
That sounds like something a director does to me. Now, you might not want
to
take credit for that.
I believe that. I say I'm like naive. You know, I remember hearing that the guys in U2 were talking, and they said that they didn't learn other people's songs when they first became a band. They just started writing their own songs. And that's kind of my approach to making movies. You know, I know that I didn't go to film school. I know that I haven't seen, you know, a lot of movies and stuff. I don't pretend that I'm a student of cinema. I have these stories to tell. And we just do them by any means, you know.
I remember once talking to a couple of stand-ups, and they said something that made me think, in a weird way, being a stand-up sets you up to be a director. Because they said you have a lot of free time during the day, and you go see a lot of movies.
Well, no, but I think it's like the same skill, especially, you know, I directed the Kimmel Show for 3 years.
Yeah.
It was like over 300 shows. And
which is really like thinking on your feet kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, you're sitting there, you're watching the show, and it's just, you know, directing is just... like stand-up comedy, because you're trying to get through this.
But you're also trying to capture accidents, like use accidents to your advantage, aren't you?
Yeah, and when you're doing stand-up, you know, there's a patron who's heckling and the waitress is dropping a tray. There's all these distractions, and you have to deliver this, you know? So the frustrating part about being a stand-up, for me, some people are really brilliant, like Pryor or something, and they could tell you a story and then get to the end and you're in tears while you're laughing. But you know, at this point in my act, I only, you know, I tell short stories. You know, it doesn't all wrap up at the end. And when you make a movie, you're allowed to do other things besides just the dessert. You know, you're allowed the whole meal.
But you also haven't made movies that wrapped up at the end either. I mean, these movies have been pointedly films that don't tie everything up in a neat little bow.
They're kind of
classic now what endings to me, which feels like a real movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, then it's funny because I think of these stories as really, really simple stories. You know, I don't see them as like a real reflection of life. But at the same time, the whole note while we're doing it for the actors and for myself is to keep everything really, strip it down, keep it really real. I think people think too, like when I sit home and write, I'm like going, well, this ought to, you know, this will really freak them out. And that isn't what I'm doing at all. You know, that just is right now the only thing that kind of interests me, you know.
How do you mean the only thing that interests you?
Because these things that I write about, even if they are considered outrageous.
Because they're shocking moments in them.
They're very shocking, but they also are kind of like real life, you know. There's so much stuff in these movies that are from real life. I haven't been close to bestiality, but, you know, I mean, there are.
But, you know, there's a famous old Claude Chabrol movie called Just Before Nightfall about this couple they're having an affair. And, you know, their partners are best friends. And the guy is asphyxiating the woman and ends up killing her by mistake, and then has to deal with the fact that he just killed his best friend's wife. I mean, this is. I mean, this is.
See, I'm not familiar with that movie at all. But by just telling you that, I go, whoa, what a great idea for a comedy. I mean, the other thing is when I'm making movies, I just assume they're going to be funny. I know that sounds cocky, but that's nothing I'm worried about if people are going to laugh. These last two movies, the big thing was, hey, can I make a movie that actually people are invested in these characters for the whole 90 minutes? Because in Shakes, I wasn't interested in that. You know, I was just – it was a really angry movie, and I was kind of like – that movie is it was just an angry movie, you know. I just watched it the other day. I wish there was a scene where Shakes was at the AA meeting and he Irishes up his coffee. Like, I wish he was giving – so people would get that wasn't even supposed to be serious. But I'm like, he's in a clown suit at a goddamn AA meeting. This is not a message film.
My guest is Bobcat Goldthwait. His new film as writer-director is World's Greatest Dad. At what point do you feel like you actually sort of got it across that there was an emotional investment? Was it because you felt like you made that investment yourself so you get people to go along with you as an audience or what?
I don't know. I mean, we were talking about that first Sundance experience with Stay or Sleeping Dogs Lie now. And I didn't know if it was going to work. I'd never seen it with an audience. So I'm sitting there for the first time watching it with an audience. And the incident, as we were saying, this woman's going to leave, you know. Because when you're at Sundance, your movie's going to be packed no matter what. And I said when I introduced it, I go, I know I'm not your first movie tonight. And there's some giggles. And I go, I know I'm not your second or third. And that was the reality. People just go to the movies. And I said, but thanks for being here. It means so much to me. So this woman, she sees the bestiality act or whatever, and she's going to leave. And her friend talks her into staying, right? Then about an hour into the movie, that woman was sobbing. She's crying. And my daughter goes, look at your friend now. And I look over and I see this lady crying. My daughter goes, yeah, you cry, bitch. You cry. And it may not work for everyone, but it did work. You know, I know that there was a lot of people who were really affected by that movie. One of the things that I think is neat about the last two movies that I made was, you know, if they work for people, if they don't or whatever. But it's really cool to walk out of the movie and everybody's animated, you know. Everybody's discussing the ideas that went on, you know, and arguing and stuff. And that's unbelievable. I'm getting, like, you know, goosebumps just thinking about that, how exciting that was and is, you know.
Yeah, because it's really the incident isn't what the movie's about. I mean, it's really about the world after that.
Yeah.
You know, about that. That's why I say that kind of that now what moment. Because that seems to me almost kind of the way you work. Kind of, okay, well, now what happens?
Definitely now what? And that's how I feel, by the way, as soon as I wake up every morning.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yes. It's so hard getting through life, you know, now what, you know? And I guess I do live in a lot of fear, you know. Some people think by watching my movies that I have, you know, dark, deep secrets that I'm trying to – but that's not it. I generally do find life kind of terrorizing.
Yeah?
Yes. Doesn't mean I'm not happy, but it is really terrifying. You know?
Okay, as you sit there and squirm in your diamond shoes, we're out of time. So I have to say thank you so much for doing this, Bobcat. Please come back.
Thanks for having me. I hope I can keep making movies and you keep having me on.
I would love to do that.
I sounded like Dirk Diggler. And I'll just keep rocking.
Well, let's not even go into that. I'll just end it here by saying my guest is Bobcat Goldthwait. His new film as writer-director is World's Greatest Dad. Our recording engineer at KCRW at Santa Monica is Mario Diaz. Our editor, and he's going to have a really good time with this show, is Bob Carlson. Gemma Dempsey produces the show. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.